A while back at the Mayo Clinic, they tested the impact of nature sounds and soft music on heart surgery patients. And by day two post-op, the pain and anxiety levels of the nature sound patients was significantly lower. So, if life is poking you in the heart right now, why not bathe in the sound of nature? It won't cure your ills, but it will make you feel better about them. Nature Sounds by Anne Jones, wherever you get your podcasts and on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
It's 1906 and 26-year-old literary sensation Miles Franklin is sailing to the USA, ready to embrace all that the world outside Australia has to offer. But as her boat approaches San Francisco, she sees only charred desolation. It resembled a vast rubbish dump, one that had been burned until there was nothing left for the flames to consume, she writes. The tram rails were melted and severed and twisted, the sidewalks cracked and broken, with deep holes everywhere from which terrible odours rose. The worst earthquake in history has killed at least 1,000 people. Finding her friends will be impossible. So will cashing her checks as all the banks are shut. No family, no money, no friends. How will I manage? She asks herself. Suddenly, a tugboat appears and a friendly voice sings out from below. American suffragists had hired a tug, captained it, and come to her rescue. She is absolutely stunned by this American can-do attitude. These women would open up a whole new exhilarating universe to Miles of feminist and unionist politics. Hello, I'm Alicia Simmons.
And I'm Lee Boucher. And this is The Dead Can't Sue. We're a couple of very serious historians who are letting loose in an ABC studio, gossiping about dead people from Australia's past because, well, it's in the name. They can't sue. Last week, we met the young Bush girl who wrote the international hit My Brilliant Career and helped establish a national literary culture. We urge you to go back and listen if you're jumping in now.
That's right. And this week, Lee, it's the second part of the Miles Franklin story. And you're right, My Brilliant Career is really what most people know her for, including myself, I've got to say, before researching this. But this week, we're going to meet Miles, the political animal.
Ooh, fun.
From exactly. And it's a wild ride from her globe-trotting feminist and labour activist days to her flirtations with no less than two brothers, millionaire brothers in Chicago, and then, well, a dash of fascism.
Ooh, okay. So every year when the Miles Franklin Literary Award is announced, I get a whiff of rumours. There's sometimes some reportage swirling around that this, you know, much-loved matriarch of Australian literature might have actually been a fascist.
Absolutely.
And look, given what I know about the ideological promiscuity of early 20th century feminists, that doesn't necessarily surprise me so much, but I do think it's a surprise to people every year to find out that this feminist icon might be, ta-da, a fascist bad girl.
Absolutely. It's that ideological promiscuity and the extent to which so many of their ideas, like eugenicism, can lead so easily actually into, and did lead so easily into fascism. But we're going to separate rumour from fact and figure this out, because that's what we do here, of course. We love the facts, but even more than the facts, we love factually based gossip. Okay, so before we go on, people at home, if we use some rude words in this episode, sorry. Please don't sue us, but let's just get straight into it. Okay, so Miles has arrived in the USA. It's a little traumatic, but by 1907, she's moved to Chicago and she settled in there. And you can imagine how exhilarating Chicago would have been for her. Like, imagine it. She's come from Talbingo, from the snowy mountains. You know, real bush girl kind of stuff. Sydney's the biggest town that she's seen. Suddenly there she is in a city with these long, seemingly endless streets, 20-story buildings, you know, sprinting icy winds, extreme luxury, extreme poverty. Okay, so Chicago at this time is filled with immigrant women and men working
working in slaughterhouses and in sweatshops.
Yep.
She goes into that world and being Miles, she does what she does best, which is make friends.
Yep.
She makes friends with the ladies and with the feminists.
Yep.
And she comes into a contact with a woman who we all should know more about, who is amazing,
yep,
called Alice Henry.
Okay.
So Alice Henry was a socialist. She was a journalist, very well known at the time. Miles meets her and they shack up together.
Mm.
And I know, in a romantic friendship kind,
yep,
of way, and in a way that mirrors Miles's friendships previous to that with,
yep,
other feminists. It's a mother-daughter,
yeah,
kind,
okay,
of bond that you're seeing. Alice Henry is a unionist.
Okay.
She is working from below,
okay,
with the women. Okay. So Miles, through that, gets connections with this glittering political circle of,
yep,
of activists, and she also ends up working at the National Women's Trade Union League of America, and later she becomes the assistant editor with Alice of its monthly journal, Life and Labor.
I love this picture we're getting of Miles in this connected, networked world of feminist friends, really.
It's and such an internationalist world,
yeah,
as well.
Connecting,
yeah,
connecting to Australia and,
absolutely,
kind of the deeply personal kind of underpinnings of these kind of contests, these political contests. And my sense,
nice,
of the US at this moment, you know, first couple of decades of the 20th century, is of deep ideological conflict,
yep,
of deep questions being asked. Those divisions that you talked about between rich and poor,
yeah,
are so sharp in America,
yeah,
and prompting really big conversations about how the world, the political world, the economic world should be ordered. Do I have that right?
You're absolutely right. So not only does America not have a minimum wage, they have no rights to collective bargaining,
yep,
at this period. So if you can imagine Miles working with these working women,
mm-hmm,
who are garment workers, who are stenographers, who are waitresses, she's working with a bunch of women who are not only not unionized, they're also in and of themselves excluded from the male union. So it's a hell of a task. And one of the things that she does, which I just adore imagining her in this scene, is it's 1910 and she helps to organize this massive protest of garment workers.
Yep.
So imagine it, this 40,000 women who walk off the job.
Yep.
They are on the streets for 6 months. And when I say on the streets, we're not talking Sydney, Melbourne on the streets.
Yep.
We're talking Chicago, absolutely bleak, windy,
yep,
freezing cold streets. There they are with their scarves on, demanding an end to the worst conditions imaginable. We're talking 16-hour days. We're talking wages, half of those of men, completely incapable of being able to support themselves, let alone if you've got a kid.
Yep.
And Miles, in the midst of this, is turning up to picket lines. She's there in the rallies.
Mm-hmm.
She's running around, collecting strikers' stories. She's writing reports and she's witnessing police brutality. It's what you said earlier,
yeah,
this extraordinary conflict. And she is absolutely in the thick of it. She's investigating these conditions,
yep,
for her writing. There's never any separation between,
mm-hmm,
the two. Her politics are also her writing, I think. And she's also at the same time, the other thing that obviously Americans don't have is the suffrage.
Yeah.
You know, and part of her first wave feminism is this belief that once women have the vote, conditions are going to improve for them because then politicians have to appeal to them.
There's an Australian sensibility there, and
yeah,
she just feels so Australian in this moment, coming from an Australian context where unionism, while radical, is also legitimate and a legitimate part of the political frame.
Absolutely.
In the Australian context, women's suffrage has been achieved.
Yeah.
I imagine, you know, she might have had that moment that I think many of us have had when we visit the US, which is meant to be the leading beacon of civilizational progress. And then you look at it as an Australian and go, oh, actually, there's some things that unfold in more interesting or progressive ways in Australia that haven't been accomplished here. And I'm sure that would have been Miles's response.
I couldn't agree more.
So talk me through her unionism, because she's from a, you know, I'm remembering that gold sateen cushion.
And purple.
Purple, sorry, thank
oil.
You. I turned it gold in my head.
Yeah, I love that.
This is about my attachments, not hers. But that purple sateen cushion, you know, she's born into a life of, if not privilege, then maybe comfort.
Yeah.
And definitely in social outlook.
Mm.
She's not coming from a radical left-wing background. How do we explain, you know, and there's nothing like cold weather to test one's political commitments, and she's clearly committed, right? She's getting out there in the cold
true.
Weather. So how do we explain her deep political commitments?
Look, I think that I would go back to that idea that she's not coming from a political family and say, actually, the family that she's coming from, you're right, she's born with a purple sateen cushion, you know, on her bottom, but at the same time, trotting along with it. But at the same time, her family experienced downward social mobility. And her father, I think her father becomes radicalised in that process. She's very close to her father. So she experiences that downward mobility and she doesn't blame her father. Mm-hmm. Instead, she absorbs the radicalism of her time, of the 1880s, 1890s, mm-hmm. precisely as you described, burgeoning radical nationalist unionist movement. Mm-hmm. She absorbs all that through her father, through her own reading. And as a result, she doesn't blame her father. She says there are exploitative conditions that are built into capitalism mm-hmm. that is unregulated by the state. We need to intervene. So I think that that's where a lot of her unionism naturally comes from. And she's suddenly close to the levers of power.
Yeah.
And that's thrilling.
Yeah.
She thinks she can change things.
It sounds intoxicating.
And you're right.
And in the intoxication of political friendship, I think we, you know, for those of us who've been in those worlds, we actually recognise this. It's recognition, but also the intoxication of having your worldview transformed, of having new ideas come to you by your friends in conversation, that you're engaged in some collective endeavour to both understand and transform the world. I'm with Miles. Get me to those. Get me to those 1907 strikes. I'm in, baby.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't underestimate the extent to which what looks like an angry protest is in fact a joyful, kind of sense of coming together. Okay, so let's take Miles back.
Yep.
She's there in Chicago. She arrives, you know, in America 1906. So it's around 1910s, 11s. It's great, it's thrilling, but it's also up and down, mm-hmm. okay? Like one of the things about Miles as a person is that she suffers insomnia and she's really anxious, you know, and mm-hmm. so she actually suffers a nervous breakdown in this period. She's hospitalised, in fact. And there is a bush girl in her that just constantly yearns to go home.
Yeah.
She never stops really being homesick for Australia and for the bush, I think. So that's going on. At the same time, she's still writing an enormous amount. She starts writing plays, she starts writing film scripts. On top of that, she's still maintaining her opposition to marriage, but is also still that massive flirt,
mm-hmm.
you know, that we came to know and love in episode one. So Jill Rowe writes, that it sometimes seems that more men propose to Miles than to Elizabeth I of England.
Well, lucky Miles.
No, totally. And it does feel like that. Wherever she goes, she seems to have men really quite besotted, you know, by her.
That tells us something, doesn't it? It tells us that she's charismatic.
Yeah.
She's clearly a charisma bomb. You know?
She really is. She's beguiling, I think. And he's also kind of famous at this time as well for just saying no to marriage.
Yeah.
So that prohibition must be something that kind
it's
of
also
you know,
tempting
people
to try and break.
Oh, without a doubt. Absolutely. So it's during this time in Chicago that she finds herself embroiled, as I said in the intro, with those two brothers. Mm-hmm. The eldest is William Bross Lloyd, millionaire, attorney, mm-hmm. Harvard graduate, the son of a great socialist journalist. Also, not that attractive, pale, weedy.
Yep, sure.
But he takes her to the opera. She's kind of, you know, quite besotted, mm-hmm. I guess, as well, you know, by him. He wines and dines her in the great hotels. He's certainly entranced by Miles. But Miles knows the entire time that he's married and he's got children, and she knows this because she's friends, in fact, with his wife. But worse than all this for Miles is the fact that he frequents brothels.
So that's a mark against him in Miles's book, right?
Absolutely. And that there is, it's not Miles being puritanical and blaming the women.
Mm-hmm.
The actual story there is that he proposes marriage to her yet again, says, I'm going to divorce, you know, whatever else. And she says, well, I know that you go to brothels. And he says, oh, don't worry, I've given that up. I'm not doing that anymore. And then she says to him, can you name any of the women that you paid for sex? And he can't.
Yeah, okay.
And that's her issue with it. So we've got to think of this period as one where women are trying to reform male sexuality.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the issue. And so she's not blaming the prostitutes. She's blaming him.
Yep.
And going, you have commodified them. You are not seeing them as whole people. What is wrong with you? Their relationship lasts until 1914, but by 1912, she starts flirting with his brother, Damaris.
Okay.
No one's off bounds for Miles.
Yep.
Or Demi. He was, by all accounts, a fine specimen of manhood. And the descriptions that I've read of him is that he's incredibly tall. He's incredibly muscular. Mm. He's tanned in contrast to William.
Yep.
Exactly. He's got ash blonde hair. People sort of describe him as distinguished. He's a few years younger than Miles and he's a political commentator, so he's clever, you know, in the Chicago Daily Tribune. And like his brother, fabulously wealthy. He's a recent divorcee and he devoted himself to automobiles, yachting around the French Riviera. The letters that he wrote to her would always start with, "My dear little rascal."
Oh, fun. So look,
it's really cute. And he would sign his off with, "From Sinbad the Sailor," talking about his peripatetic ways.
So, you know, we all know how much easier it is to flirt and get a bit besotted by someone who has millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
That does make that slide a little easier. Even more so when, you know, it's the handsome, fine specimen of manhood.
Yeah.
You know, we've all had our eyes turned in that direction occasionally, perhaps. But was she, you know, what? She's anti-marriage.
Yeah.
Right, or at least as I understand it, she's got an opposition to the idea of marriage as something that's going to entrap women and inhibit their political and social freedom.
Yeah.
So what's her – how is she – do we know what kind of future she's imagining with, like, are we going to have a ménage à trois with the two brothers in a house? Like, what's – how's she imagining the future of these relationships?
She's structurally, absolutely politically opposed to marriage, as are many women at this time. She's not alone in arguing this stuff. It's a big argument for first-wave feminists. But for her personally, Jill Rowe, her main biographer, says, look, her biological clock is kind of ticking.
Yep.
She is actually open to the idea.
Yep.
She's a eugenicist, and to that extent, she is interested in American men, she thinks, more than Australian men. Make of that what you will. But for her personally, she says, look, she never regretted not marrying William.
Okay.
But she did most definitely consider marrying Demi.
That fine specimen of manhood.
Well, manhood.
He fits the eugenic bill, right?
He really does.
He's a good person to reproduce with.
Yeah, absolutely. And their courtship, you know, dancing, motoring in his lavish automobiles, getting letters from the French Riviera. Of course, that would have been so intoxicating.
Her unionism is feeling a little less radical right now, I've just got to say. You know, we've got the strike, you know, the strike leading Miles. Now she's off pootling around in rich men's cars.
But can I say, Lee, I could imagine her excuse for that would be that these two are the sons of one of the most significant socialist journalists of the 19th century. I'm just thinking myself into Miles's world.
Yeah, thinking.
I guess that's how I would sort of justify it. But, yeah, the affair seems to have ended because, and this is quite awful, you know, it seems to have ended because of an attempted abduction and rape.
Oh, okay.
So in 1914, after a really dangerous trip to Providence in Rhode Island, she wrote in her diary, and I quote, "He was desperate and brutal in an unprecedented degree when drunk. She escaped death or tragedy by small margin." And there's a recent book that's come out about Miles by Alexandre Lapierre, and she novelises this period, this moment, I think really quite beautifully. So she imagines them, you know, having gone off in his car, they've gone out for dinner or something, he's gotten way too drunk. She tries to escape. She's kind of terrified. Mm-hmm. She doesn't want to get into the car. He bundles her into the car. She tries to escape again and he beats her and tries to rape her. It's brutal. We don't know. She's probably speculating, but yeah, that's certainly what happened.
So, you know, again, Miles's opposition to marriage is sounding more and more legitimate as we're talking about the gender relations between men and women that she's encountering.
Yeah.
You know, like, why would you commit to something that's very hard to escape when that might be what's contained within it?
Absolutely.
But the thing I'm also struck by is when you're mentioning her notebook here, you know, we hear Miles Franklin, we hear notebook, we think diary, we think, oh, I'm going to get to the real Miles here. I'm going to get inside her head, you know. And I think many of us would hope that if you come across the diary of some well-known figure, you're suddenly going to find the real Miles in that notebook. But the excerpts you've been reading here, and I'm listening to them, and they sound so formal. They sound so like they're written not for herself. They're not necessarily her internal self flowing onto the page, but quite carefully crafted pieces of literature. You know, so is the notebook, you know, the inner Miles? Is this the real Miles we're getting here? How do you read these notebooks?
Lee, you're so right. And that is something that has frustrated all of her biographers. You know, they get these notebooks and they go, fantastic. She's got about five different ones, you know, for different things. And what they find is a notebook and a diary that is written with an audience in mind, you know, that she imagines. I think she has an eye to posterity. I think she's, through her archival remains, creating a kind of monument to herself.
Yep.
And we're aware of the extent to which being Miles, being this incredibly secretive person who is constantly writing under pseudonyms, playing with her identity. One of the things that people say about Miles is that if you would call her up when she lived in Carlton later on in her life, she would always pretend to be somebody else when she answered the phone. And so you'd go, is Miles there? And she would say, hang on, I'll just go and see. And then you'd hear her pattering away and then coming back and going, hi, like if she decided to talk to you. So she's really interesting in that way that she's a very difficult person to get to. And some biographers, like Marjorie Barnard, for instance, goes more to her novels.
Mm.
And that actually helps us to understand this situation in particular, in that 2 days after the attempted rape and abduction, she starts a novel called Red Cross Nurse, which involves a brutal account of the abduction and attempted rape of a young working woman narrator by a wealthy suitor. And, you know, you can join the dots there. Mm-hmm. It's
So I'm really interested in, I've got to say, what are her sexual politics or her attitudes towards sex? She's encountering the brutality of some men in situations where they take advantage or push things to, you know, they get angry, you know, she's encountering some pretty disgraceful attitudes. We've mentioned she's got, you know, attitudes towards brothels and around men's behaviour. But what about her own pleasure and flirtation? And then we've got her flirtatious Miles. I guess, putting it bluntly, what's her attitude to sex?
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it, on a personal level?
Yeah.
I think it's interesting in that I think she is caught historically. I'll start panning out first.
Yep.
She's caught historically between first wave feminism, which is, as we've said, trying to reform male sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
It's trying to make male sexuality closer to female sexuality. She's caught between that and the flapper.
Yeah, okay.
And the flapper in between those two is Freud.
Yeah.
Okay, basically.
Yep.
Is this kind of sexual revolution that comes through all the sexologists, through therapeutic discourse, infiltrating popular culture at that time. And with that, you have the inversion of what first wave feminists argued.
Mm-hmm.
So first wave feminists say male sexuality needs to look more like female sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Freud says the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Female sexuality needs to start behaving more like male sexuality. So she doesn't, I think as a person, she never comes to terms with that. I think that she remains, she says at the end of her life very proudly, I'm a proud virgin.
Okay.
You know, she says she's very committed to this social purity sort of idea, says she never gives that away. But at the same time, you're right, she's really flirtatious.
Mm.
Like I think I just keep thinking, frustrated. So she just can't find a way out of first wave feminism, as feminists did in the 1970s,
yeah,
towards a more egalitarian kind of notion of sexuality.
Yeah, the ideological, political dynamism of these years, you know.
It's so interesting.
It is, isn't it?
You know,
just so much is up for grabs. How do we live? Who are we? How should we treat each other? What should our social relations be? What is the place of unions? What is the place of capital? The liveliness of this political, cultural, intellectual context. And she's just in the middle of it.
I've got to say, Lee, every time people ask that question at dinner parties of like, what historical epoch would you go back to? It's just so easy for me. I'm like, 1890s to 1910s.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
It's so radical.
It's up for grabs.
And so utopian.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So there she is. She's in the US and World War I has kicked off in Europe, okay? So she decides, 1915, she decides to leave the US for England, beginning what's been termed the European turn in the life of Miles Franklin. She's anti-war, she's anti-conscription, and she arrives in London to help out on the home front. And she does it in the same way she's done in America and in Sydney. She makes friends with the feminists.
Yep.
She's introduced to them already. She also writes prolifically about the war effort in London, and she has some of these articles published in Australia.
So what does the war do to Miles? What does confronting the realities of the war, you know, this, she's anti-war, but she's also helping on the home front.
Yeah.
So what, how is she?
Well, imagine it in her everyday life. She is seeing these soldiers, these young men going off to war, and she's questioning the absurdity of it. She becomes a real pacifist.
Yep.
So a very committed pacifist. So she'd always been anti-conscription, but there's a lovely line from her where she says, "It is impossible to live in any of the belligerent countries without feeling a deep affection for the soldiers. Just gentle, ordinary people, full of gaiety and bravado, despite being assembled for the slaughter, just like cattle in the Chicago stockyards." At the same time, what's interesting for her personally is that she feels this resurgent sense of national pride.
Mm.
She's seeing the Anzacs. She starts to wear a little pin in the, on the inside of her coat of an Australian flag. You know, she's feeling an emotional kind of identification, which has never gone with Australia, but it's really coming back in full force.
I want to draw attention here. This is a woman who has engaged in various critiques of male behaviour for 20 years.
Yeah.
Suddenly confronted with, you know, what historians call the cost of masculinity in wartime, which is the cost of being a man is having your body thrown into militarised industrial warfare in World War One, and it would, I imagine, really challenge in productive ways a kind of sympathetic relationship to men.
Yeah, it does. And that continues through to after the war, where she sees the toll, the psychic toll on men, but also the physical toll on women who become the victims of domestic violence because of these traumatized men. You know, so it's really interesting. But it's during this period and in the aftermath of war that she turns her mind to housing, which sounds really boring, but is actually a huge issue, you know, at this period. The apartments that people are living in the UK are squalid, you know, terrible kind of conditions. She's interested in urban planning, what do you do about pollution, all of those things. So she ends up working in that area for around 8 years, but they're pretty grim, sad years for her, actually, because her boss, who has extraordinary social status, everyone loves him, is in fact a philandering, embezzling megalomaniac. He's really nasty piece of work. She sees it, you know, up close, firsthand, and she ends up leaving during this period. She says she's homesick. She becomes more and more homesick, and she decides to visit Australia for the first time in 18 years.
Oh, wow, okay.
A long time that she's been away, right? So there's also tragedy in the family. By 1925, her mother had lost all but two of her seven children. You know, imagine the tragedy of that.
Yep.
And Miles is hearing this. Every time she gets a letter about something like this, it just floors her. It absolutely kills her. Partly also because she goes, this happened 2 months ago. Why am I only finding out now? Imagine it. So she moves back for good in 1927. And it's interesting, this period of her life, because it actually coincides with an extraordinary moment of creative energy from Miles. So this is a moment where, among all the other names that we've seen her take on in her life, she invents the last one, which is Brent of Bin Bin. So Australiana.
Oh, that's a good one.
I know. So she starts publishing a pastoral saga under this name about a year after returning to Australia. She writes like crazy. No one knew that Brent of Bin Bin was the author of My Brilliant Career. And the novels were a massive hit.
So I remember when Stephen King wanted to, you know, the very famous author, wanted to test, you know, friends would say to him, people only buy your novels because they see your name. It's got nothing to do with how good they are. So he published some novels under a pseudonym to see if they'd sell. Yeah, and they didn't. And then someone figured it out. That's my understanding of the story. So, you know, she's, you know, this idea of your literary reputation sort of determining how people are going to read you.
Yeah.
Right? So the name Miles Franklin has a whole set of things attached to it.
Yeah.
And she then publishes something under a different name. Is she trying to escape the power of her name? Is she, what's she trying? Why is this, what's going on with this new pseudonym?
Yeah, I think that what you see in all of Miles' pseudonyms is an experimentation with the self. It's a playing with forms of androgynous, you know, or gender bending, you know, kind of identity, I think. But I think in this instance, she's publishing about the land and she's publishing about the Australian squatocracy. To that extent, it is a pledge of authenticity.
Yeah, okay.
Right? So if you're going to write a bush yarn, you have to be a bloke.
So it's about authorial voice, authorial legitimacy, how she will be read, how she'll be understood, and the things that she's talking about. Does it work? Does she pull it off? Are they a success?
They are a massive success. The novels, which are called things like Up the Country, were this nostalgic evocation. By the 1920s, they're a nostalgic evocation of a time now very much past.
Yeah, okay.
You know, so in the midst of this extraordinary social upheaval and change, people feel reassured, you know, particularly in the midst of this flourishing Australian nationalism, by these bush myths, by these bush yarns.
But it's also the comfort of the pioneering story in the 1920s. That seems to me to be the key thing that we're talking about here.
I don't think it ever goes away.
Yeah.
Does it?
No.
Don't we still have, like, you know, any time, like, if we think about nostalgia, it is still this kind of, you know, evocation of a pastoral ideal, whether it be in England or Australia.
Yeah, and it sounds like she's nestling straight in there, but also doing really interesting things with it in a literary sense.
Yeah, I think she does still, look, biographers say that she does still maintain her politics to the end. You know, some biographies have said of this period, where's her feminism?
Yeah,
you know, suddenly she's just writing about all these blokes in the bush.
Yep.
And, you know, other biographers, particularly Marjorie Barnard, who knew her, said, oh, don't worry, she never stopped being cranky.
Yeah.
Like, she never stopped campaigning around this stuff, at least personally. But it's also around this time, so we're talking sort of 1930s by this period, that her father dies and her money runs low. And that's a period where she actually returns to her original pen name, which I really love.
Yeah.
Like, finally, you know, she's back again. And she writes a book that becomes very famous called All That Swagger. And that wins the prestigious Prior Prize and really restores her reputation in Australia as a writer. One of the judges, T.D. Mutch, says that Miles is, and I quote, at the zenith of her power. In not one page is there to be seen any evidence of overseas influence. Only an Australian could have written it. And there has been nothing written like it except the Brent of Bin Bin novels.
Did he know?
No.
Did he know?
No,
that's great.
Oh, that's, isn't it gorgeous?
That's perfection. But also that we've got the nationalism here. You know, this is a literary culture, an emerging, consolidating literary culture where the best thing you can be is purely Australian, free from overseas influence, manifesting Australian sensibilities to other Australians to read.
Absolutely. War breaks out again a year later, and this is where we get to the fascism rumours.
Okay, I'm ready.
Because in 1941, she attends a few meetings of the pro-fascism and Nazism Australia First movement.
Okay, I'm having, look, you know, again, having heard the read the rumours, you know, it is very discomforting to hear the word, the hear the words Miles Franklin and Nazi in the same sentence.
Oh, no.
It's, you know, it's disturbing. So let's figure out help me figure out what's going on here.
Yeah.
What exactly is this group?
Look, Miles, can I just say about hearing the phrase Miles Franklin and Nazi in the same sentence, Miles is always explicitly anti-Nazi.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so the question is more fascist.
Yep, okay.
But the Australia First movement was started by Percy Stevenson with retired businessman W.J. Miles. And his idea was that Australia should stay out of European imbroglios and put Australia first.
Yep.
Clive Palmer style. Though this ultra-nationalism quickly headed in a fascist direction. So before 1939, it described itself as being, and I quote, for national socialism, i.e. Nazism, and for Aryanism against Semitism. Okay, so it's kind of like it's kind of explicit.
Yeah.
It wasn't large. Its inaugural meeting in 1941 drew 212 attendees, including undercover police. So Jill Rowe, on the other hand, contends that Miles attended because the Australia First Movement president, Percy Inkey Stevenson, was a really good friend of hers and her publisher, but that she clearly opposed the views of the movement around Nazism. She supported, in fact, she very explicitly attends rallies and she supports the movement against war and fascism.
Yep, okay.
So she is there as well.
Yeah, okay. So her politics are complicated, but, you know, we've got to also remember the eugenicist attachment to racial health and racial purity that's in her back gears. But also I, you know, on a personal note, like when I joined Macquarie, I think nearly two decades ago now, which is the only thing I don't want to confront, but, you know, I joined Macquarie. Jill Rowe was at Macquarie for many, many, many years. And Jill's work on Miles, everyone had spoken about it for years and years and years. She had been working on this biography, this what would become an absolute doorstopper of a book, i.e. it's big.
Huge. Yeah.
I just wonder about, is Jill letting Miles off the hook a little bit here? Like, what's going on with Jill's relationship to Miles that means she says, oh, it's just because her friend was there and she, but don't worry, she was still opposed to the fascists.
And also that question of like, well, why are you friends with this person?
Yeah.
Like this guy is, sure, I can understand at the beginning, Miles is also a bit of an ultra-nationalist.
Yeah.
She also shares the same eugenicist concerns. She's worried about racial decay. But I think you're right. I think that after 10 years of writing a biography with someone, there is this kind of over-identification, you know, this sympathetic identification with them that might blind you to some of it. Look, Jill's argument, this is Jill's word. She says, in her view, and by that she means Miles, as part of the desired new moral standard, small nations off the beaten track should stand out for peace. That explains her interest in it because they're opposed to them going to war. And she claimed to have not seen the anti-Semitism until a friend from overseas points it out. But I've got to say, Miles also writes to her friend, this is also there in the diary, in her diaries and her letters in London, that this movement, whose meetings she attends, at least three, and whose magazine she continues to subscribe to, so the magazine, she doesn't stop subscribing to it, and Miles writes to her friend and says, this movement is very much needed.
Ooh, okay. So maybe one way through all this, you know, is to let ourselves, free ourselves from our desire to identify with the ideal feminist hero Miles. Like, obviously she is a complicated, complex thinker in a period of intense political and ideological contest and contradiction, and she is finding her way through this. We shouldn't be looking for our perfect feminist Miles Franklin, but trying to think about her in this really complicated period of time.
We love complexity.
Yeah.
Like you like go into that.
Yeah.
Be able to hold these two ideas in your head at the same time and explore the links between them. So absolutely.
And there's not easy answers to these questions.
No.
Feminism is not easy. It's not easy to figure out what to do. There's not a single right way to do it.
Yeah.
It is complicated and contradictory. And what we should be doing is trying to get at that contradiction and complexity.
So we don't repeat it. Okay, so in this period, as I said, she's a tireless lady scribbler.
Yep.
Like she just doesn't stop writing and it's really her final burst of creativity mm-hmm. before she dies. In 1946, she publishes the sequel to My Brilliant Career, which fabulously is titled My Career Goes Bung. I love that.
Yeah, great.
And remember back to the first episode, that book was rejected the first time that she wrote it, so she's revising it now mm-hmm. and she publishes it. By this stage, she's very much a founding mother of Australian literature. She's giving lectures everywhere. She's on the radio and she's celebrated, you know, as a kind of mentor of a younger generation.
There's Miles, the political activist, in the protests, on the strikes in Chicago, and then there's Miles, the writer of Brent of Bin Bin pastoral sagas.
And romances and also romance. In between this.
Yeah. So why do you know, how do we relate those two things to each other? And also, why have we kind of forgotten her activism and political kind of work here?
I know. It's so interesting, isn't it? Like, I think firstly we just have to say that she sees her writing as a form of political activism, and you see that from My Brilliant Career through to her stuff around domestic servants, through to her stuff around war. She writes her way into positions of power. The pen is mightier than the sword.
Yep.
You know, I think she definitely has that idea. But also, you know, she's there on the front lines. The thing is, she's on the front lines and then she goes back and writes about it later at night. So you have that. She's trying to change the world through her writing. By the time she's died, she's published somewhere between 14 and 19 books in her lifetime, depending on if you count edited collections, and they're all under various pen names, but none had ever reached the fame of her first.
Oh, second album syndrome. It stuck with it till the end. But I just, you know, our biggest literary awards take their name from Miles Franklin. The Miles Franklin Award and the Stella. She has this, you know, incredibly significant part in our literary imagination. What story do you want to tell about Miles now? How do you want her to be remembered?
Oh, interestingly, look, I personally would like her to be remembered as a social justice activist, mm-hmm. I think, first and foremost. I feel like that also sums up her writing. You know, you could say on top of that that she's a feminist, she's a writer, she's a nationalist, she's an internationalist.
Yeah.
And she's this great big fabulous flirt. Whatever I think of her, mm-hmm. the Miles Franklin Award exists because she left her estate, which was valued at £8,922, to found an award for Australian literature. And I've got to say, this was a huge shock to everyone.
Yeah.
She lived so frugally. No one had any idea that she's doing this.
So how much is that in today's money?
That's around $200,000.
Right, okay, sure.
In today's money, As for who she actually genuinely really was, it remains a question.
Yeah.
You know, every single biographer ends going, who knows?
Yep.
She was just so secretive and so mercurial. You know, at the same time, if we think about her fascism or her flirtation certainly with fascism, she's attending those meetings. She's also attending anti-war meetings.
Yeah.
She's also attending anti-Nazi meetings. You know, I think that phrase that you had earlier about her being politically what did you say?
Promiscuous?
She was politically promiscuous.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
I think that's really true.
Okay, final question. Have you got our biopic tagline for the next Miles Franklin movie that we might like to get made?
You know what? I'm a fan of alliteration, so I was sort of thinking, you know, fierce, feminist, fabulously flirty, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I actually just then thought maybe the best biopic tagline would be, it's complicated.
Love it. Good historians, bad movie makers.
Exactly. Lee, it has been such a joy gossiping about Miles Franklin with you.
Back at you, Alicia.
If you know someone who loves history or gossip, or just two historians letting loose in an ABC studio, share the Dead Can't Sue with them. Go on.
If you have some juicy gossip about someone dearly departed, or just someone you'd like us to dig up the dirt on, then send an email to thedeadcan'tsue@abc.net.au.
We've chucked a bunch of links to our sources in the show notes. Go on and do some further reading. We dare you.
The Dead Can't Sue is an ABC Audio Studios podcast made on the land of the Kulin Nation and on Gadigal Country. It's produced by Hannah Jose, video producer Christian Harrimanow, supervising producer Hannah Riche, and executive producers Claire Rawlinson and Eric George. Jessica Radburn is the head of Audio On Demand.
I'm Alicia Simmons, Associate Professor at UTS.
I'm Lee Boucher, Associate Professor at Macquarie University.
And we can't wait to gossip about the Dead again next week.